Airlines Confidential with Ben Baldanza and Scott McCartney is made possible with support from Pratt & Whitney, committed to working smarter, cleaner, and greener today for a more sustainable tomorrow. Learn more at PrattWhitney.com. DoHop, revolutionizing travel connectivity. Learn how to unlock unlimited connections simply at DoHop.com. And Cirium, the world's most trusted source of aviation analytics. Visit Cirium.com. We also welcome your business's support. Info at airlinesconfidential.com.
Welcome to Airlines Confidential. I'm Scott McCartney, president of the Tortured Airline Podcasters Department. I don't have 31 songs about a breakup like Taylor Swift dropped on her fans last week, but I do have one fun story about a standby flight change on one of my trips last week. I look forward to sharing that story, Ben Baldanza.
I look forward to hearing that story, Scott, and I look forward to your interview with the legendary Sam Coates. Sam has lived much of modern aviation history. He and I worked together at Continental. He probably thought of me then as a young whippersnapper, but was always willing to lend a hand. I learned a lot from him. He also worked at Braniff. He was president of Muse Air and then was at Southwest. He has served as the chairman of the DFW Airport Board. He's seen the industry from all its various sides, and I think he'll have some interesting things to say about air travel, and I don't think he'll be tortured about it at all.
Not at all, Ben. You know who else is not a tortured poet? It's Scott Kirby, the chief executive of United Airlines. United reported a first quarter net loss of $124 million that was smaller than last year and smaller than Wall Street expectations. Significantly, United said its revenue in the quarter was almost 10% higher than a year ago. Capacity was up 9%. The airline also said it would have been profitable if not for a $200 million revenue hit from the three-week grounding of MAX 9 aircraft in January. And even more significantly, Kirby said, "There's nothing torturous about the current quarter." United raised its estimates of earnings for April, May, and June. United said it converted some MAX 10 orders at Boeing into MAX 9 for delivery next year through 2027. The MAX 10, as listeners know, hasn't been certified by the FAA yet and may not for several years. The MAX 9 obviously is certified because it's flying. United also said it struck deals with two leasing firms for a total of 35 Airbus A321neos expected to be delivered in 2026 and 2027. That will help smooth out capacity constraints down the road. This year, United said at the beginning of the year it expected to take delivery of 101 narrowbody airplanes. Now it expects only 61 narrowbodies in 2024. I think Taylor Swift needs to do an album about tortured airline fleet planners.
It certainly is a challenge, Scott. United's results were strong. Even though the airline had losses in the quarter, Delta squeaked out a small profit in the first quarter, and United would have done the same if it hadn't had the MAX 9 grounding. Presumably, Boeing will make up some of that. The other U.S. airline impacted by the MAX 9 grounding was Alaska Airlines, and Alaska also reported its first quarter results last week. Alaska reported a net loss of $142 million, almost the same as the $143 million net loss the airline reported a year earlier. Alaska said it has received initial compensation from Boeing for the MAX 9 grounding of $162 million. Passenger revenue was up a whopping 31% from a combination of more traffic and higher fares. Capacity was up 14%, and Alaska filled almost 80% of its seats, up 3 percentage points from the first quarter of 2023. Like United, Alaska raised expectations for the second quarter, and like United, Wall Street responded to the news. Alaska shares were up about 9% last week. United shares were up more than 20%.
It's fascinating how strong demand has been for airline tickets when other parts of the economy may have started to show some weakness. I suppose a consumer pullback could catch up to airlines, and they often are a lagging economic factor rather than a leading indicator. but I think it also shows just how important travel is to consumers these days. They may pull back on retail spending or home buying, but airline tickets are very much a priority. A couple of other news items, Ben. JetBlue, as you know, hired Daniel Schurz, the former Frontier Airlines executive, to head revenue, network, and enterprise planning. Daniel will report to Marty St. George. Daniel is a really smart guy, and it looks like JetBlue is building a top-notch team. We need to mention yet another serious near-runway incursion at Washington's Reagan National Airport. A Southwest flight was cleared to cross runway 4 just as a JetBlue flight was rolling for takeoff on runway 4. Controllers on duty realized their mistake and ordered both aircraft to stop in time, but they came within 400 feet of each other. The FAA has been on high alert for runway incursions and control tower mistakes, and yet they keep happening. Some airports are starting to get more sophisticated ground tracking systems that will help controllers curb runway incursions. But once again, the need for technology shows how urgent this is to prevent accidents. Pilot situational awareness and controller situational awareness are both so important, and it's really sad that our airports and airways are so far behind on technology that can save lives. And late Friday, in a somewhat related announcement, the FAA said it would move to 10-hour rest periods between shifts for air traffic controllers. The current requirement is only 9 hours. The controllers' union had said the DCA incident was a result of fatigue. Fatigue for controllers has been blamed in some of the other incidents. And there was just a recent high-level scientific report put out about air traffic controller fatigue. I've only had a chance to look through it quickly, but it looks like the report basically says there are serious issues here that need deeper and more sophisticated study. This rule change to 10 hours puts air traffic controllers on par with minimum requirements for pilots and flight attendants. That seems like it should have been the case all along, but don't anyone think this is going to solve the controller fatigue issue. The staffing shortage continues to drive large overtime and six-day work weeks at many facilities. There's a long way to go, but this is probably a good no-brainer first step. Let's hope the rule change doesn't cause more delays all by itself. And Ben, Southwest Airlines is launching a new marketing campaign this week called the Big Flex. Southwest is highlighting flexibility and simplicity in its rules and lack of fees. Coincidentally, I had an experience on Southwest last week that I thought was worth mentioning because I found it kind of amusing. I was in Durham, North Carolina, traveling back home to Dallas, and I had booked the last connection possible on Southwest because I thought I might have to meet with students after our last class. But I finished up with the class with enough time, I thought, to make the Southwest nonstop to Dallas at 4:15 p.m. I got on the Southwest app as I walked to my car on campus at Duke, and it showed 8 seats available on the nonstop, and I could do the same-day standby for free since I'm A-list on Southwest, or I could confirm a seat for $9.50. That's a no-brainer. Take the confirmed. I tapped to complete the transaction and noticed that it said minus $9.50. Didn't quite understand that, but I gathered Southwest was actually going to pay me back a bit for taking the nonstop. That credit seemed unnecessary given how fully booked the flight was, but I'll take it. What kind of airline pays you to change flights? In fact, the flight departed completely full. It's not like they had a whole bunch of empty seats. I should note that the app actually didn't work for me for rebooking. I had to call Southwest as I drove to the airport. The agent couldn't have been more helpful. I had a boarding pass, a credit, and a big smile before I got to the rental car return lot. Expensive airline fees plaguing travelers? Balderdash! I was getting paid for making a change to a flight and getting home 5 hours earlier. What a business this is.
I'm surprised that the nonstop was cheaper than the connection. That's the opposite of most airline behavior. I'd bet this was an anomaly for Southwest too, but once they showed you, good for them to honor it.
I hope Southwest can make money by paying you to fly them, Scott. And by the way, the Big Flex sounds like a title for a movie about pumping iron or maybe work from home schedules. I wish Daniel Schur's luck as well, Scott. I think he'll be great for JetBlue. And I wish Spirit Airlines luck in their new headquarters. Our friend and roving correspondent Chris Sloan sent some pictures of the handsome new offices, and I have to say, it's not really a good look for an airline that's furloughing employees and struggling to conserve cash. Fancy offices rarely drive better earnings. When I was at Spirit, we had an office in a nondescript business park. We didn't even have a receptionist. We joked that if you don't have an armed guard, you're paying too much in rent.
Well, I'm sure Spirit probably has an armed guard now. It did look very nice. Looked a lot like some other fancy airline offices I've seen with all kinds of fancy decorations in the offices themselves. One thing that is clear, Ben, is that Airlines Confidential wouldn't exist without the support of our sponsors. We want to thank Pratt & Whitney. At Pratt & Whitney, the pursuit of more sustainable aviation is foundational. For decades, Pratt & Whitney has been at the forefront of revolutionary advancements in aircraft propulsion technology. And by working smarter, cleaner, and greener today, they are committed to supporting the aviation industry in its goal of reaching net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. Learn more about Pratt & Whitney's smarter technology, cleaner fuel, and greener business at prattwhitney.com.
And we want to thank DoHop, which is revolutionizing travel connectivity. DoHop is a travel technology provider enabling airlines to expand their networks, offer more connectivity, create additional partnerships, and focus on improving the customer experience with more offers, services, and travel options. Airlines benefit from generating additional revenue, lower costs, and maintaining full customer ownership. Plus, in the event of travel disruptions, DoHop works with airlines and offers assistance in helping passengers reach their final destination. Visit DoHop.com. That's DoHop.com.
And let's thank Cirium as well. Cirium offers the most accurate and precise data and analytics to enable airlines to optimize planning, operations, and passenger services. The right intelligence drives operational efficiencies, enables you to predict market shifts, and helps airlines respond quickly to maximize revenue, manage costs, and seize commercial opportunity. Visit Cirium.com for more. Let's bring in my conversation with Sam Coates, which I think you're going to find fascinating, Ben. Sam Coates has had one of the best seats imaginable to see the changes in the airline industry over many decades. He started as a lawyer at Texas International, Texas Treetop, as we called it, under Frank Lorenzo. He went to Braniff, then to Southwest, then to Musair, then to Continental Airlines. As Ben said, he worked with Sam at Continental. More recently, Sam was chairman of the board of Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. He's been a corporate fireman sent in to restructure everything from Schlotzky's sandwiches to the Dallas Convention and Visitors Bureau. He was president and CEO of Pros Pricing, an airline revenue management firm, and he was instrumental in getting the city of Dallas to name the road leading into Dallas Love Field as Herb Kelleher Way. Sam, it's such a pleasure to have you on Airlines Confidential. I don't know where to begin, really, but let's start with what led you to the aviation world. You grew up on a farm in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. How in the world did you end up in aviation?
Well, I wish I could say I was on that farm all the time growing up, but we had a farm outside of LaFerrière where I was born, not in a hospital. I was born in the farmhouse on a dirt road. Mm. My dad worked at the Harlingen Air Force Base in a warehouse during World War II. And at the end of the war, they closed the base. It was a bombardier training base. And we moved to the big city of Harlingen, 7 miles away, with a cow and some chickens and several cats. The neighbors were not impressed. They thought the Clampets had arrived. The mother and daddy and his mother and six kids. The cow and the chickens disappeared pretty quickly. But I have an older brother who is a fighter pilot, and he's always been my role model. And that was my first love of aviation. That plus, as a Cub Scout, I got to fly what was then Trans-Texas Airways, or as you put it, Texas Treetop, or take the train always, or try again, from Harlingen to Brownsville and back. And I think I still had the ticket. It was $2 and something. And half of our Cub Scout den got sick and threw up on the airplane. Mm-hmm. The irony was that the station manager in Harlingen was a guy named Sam Ashmore, who in later years, when I was at Texas International and then at Continental, Sam was head of properties and facilities for the whole airline. And a splendid guy who I still miss a lot. But in law school, I took an administrative law course, and I also worked for a law firm in Austin as a flunky clerk. And one of the lawyers called me after I had graduated and said they had just, that some young guys had just taken over Texas International, and they were looking for a new general counsel, and would I be interested? I thought at age 32 to become chief legal officer for a publicly held airline was something I couldn't resist. So my wife thought I was crazy. I took a $20,000 a year pay cut to work for Frank Lorenzo, and that was the beginning. It, wow. Before I had started, our firm had actually represented Braniff and had done some work for Texas International. As an aside, I handled Harding Lawrence's divorce from his first wife so that he could marry Mary Wells. and that was quite an experience. He used to phone and scream at me from all over the world. He said, "I bought Panagra quicker than this." And I said, "Harding, you were in charge. You're not in charge in this divorce proceeding, so we just have to play it out." But we got it done. And then they hired me to handle his adoption of Mary's two children, which fortunately we were successful in doing. So, you know, he was somebody right out of Central Casting. Yeah. Big, good-looking guy and just, you know, fit all the qualities of somebody who was a movie star.
I've heard of a lot of different things in aviation, but handling divorces.
I know. Well, when I was a baby lawyer, I did everything in my law firm nobody else wanted to do. Yeah. So in addition to, you know, helping on labor matters with Braniff as carrying the briefcase for one of our partners, you know, if there was something that needed to be done, it all came downhill and I was at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah. So you worked at a lot of airlines, and I didn't even mention 2 years running an airline in Brisbane, Australia. But I'm curious, what do you think makes an airline successful, and why do some fail?
Well, you know, being undercapitalized is always a major issue. And that was one of the issues that we faced in Australia. And frankly, that was one of the issues that Musair faced. I could give you several others that face it. Legend here in Dallas.
Sure.
Was undercapitalized. So you really need that. And then aviation seems to attract dreamers. And there's always somebody who thinks, you know, we ought to start an airline and do this. And oftentimes those concepts are not well enough thought out to really be successful. I doubt if you could do a Southwest Airlines in 2024. You know, Herb and Rollin King, timing is everything. And they had the right timing. They had the right concept. They were modest. They stuck to their guns. They kept it simple. And to this day, Southwest tends to keep it as simple as any airline I know of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mentioned that you worked to make Herb Kelleher Way a reality, which I've always deeply appreciated. Tell us about the Herb you knew.
Herb and I became friends fighting each other in the courtroom. The very first expansion that Southwest attempted from the Triangle, you know, their initial flights were Dallas, San Antonio, Houston. And their first extension was to Harlingen, Texas, which happened to be my hometown. I think that's one of the reasons Frank Lorenzo hired me, because he thought I had more stroke in Harlingen than it turned out that I did. But we delayed them several years. And in the process, and a lot of hearings before the Texas Aeronautics Commission, Herb and I gained a respect and affection for each other. He and Colleen were there every day. And I was there every day with a guy named Jim Wilson, who was a partner at McGinnis Lockridge. And as I said, we delayed them a couple of years, but the inevitable was they got that route. And that opened the door for them to do a considerable expansion within the state of Texas. Later on, when I decided to leave Texas International, Herb tried to hire me at that time. And I thought it would look bad. And in hindsight, I think I was wrong, but I thought at the time it would look bad if I went directly from Texas International to Southwest Airlines. So I ran a nonprofit organization in Austin for a couple of years, then got recruited to go to Braniff, ran into Herb on a flight to New York. And he said, if it doesn't work out at Braniff, come on over here. Huh. And after Braniff, sure enough, he offered me a job as vice president of external affairs. And I went to Southwest Airlines. He used to tease me that I had built a fairly good career on an unblemished string of defeats.
Such a Herb line.
Yeah. He was such a great mentor. I tell my kids, even to this day, you can have good mentors and you can have bad mentors, and you can learn equally from either one. Mm-hmm. And Herb was the kind of guy that you wanted to emulate in the way he treated people. He was very much of a people person, and he created that culture from the top at Southwest Airlines. And I've always had a deep respect for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
As far as Herb Kelleher Way, I was having lunch with Colleen Barrett and her assistant one day, and she suggested that, you know, we really need to do something to honor Herb. And that was the idea that came to the surface. He didn't know we were going to do it. Mm-hmm. And when I went to the council to offer or have the city offer the ordinance changing the name to Herb Kelleher Way.
This is the Dallas City Council.
The city council. One of the council people said, Sam, we don't normally do this for somebody who's still alive.
Yeah.
And I said, hell, he should have been dead 30 years ago, the way drinks and smokes. Everybody got a kick out of that. And sure enough, when we had the ceremony at Love Field, Herb brought every member of the city council a bottle of Wild Turkey. Just typical of him. Uh-huh. He was a dear friend and a great mentor.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Besides Herb, tell us about some of the other CEOs you worked for. Strengths and weaknesses. Lasting impression?
Frank is a friend to this day, but he was one of those that I learned how not to treat people from. Mm-hmm. Frank Lorenzo is one of the brightest guys I've ever known. He was a deal guy, and he would fall in love with an officer. And the minute he fell out of love, you know, we went through 9 positions in a 11-member senior management team the first 2 years I was at Texas International.
Wow.
That's not how you build a stable organization.
Yeah.
Guys would last sometimes 6 months or less. And Frank was just a tough guy. And I think that eventually that's what did him in You know, he built the largest airline company in the world at one time because he had merged himself into Continental. He had Frontier. He had People Express. He had Eastern. He had New York Air and probably a couple that I haven't mentioned. But he has so alienated the unions that over time, that was his Achilles heel.
Yeah.
And he never, you know, once the board at Continental fired him, he never got back in the industry.
No, and in fact got banned.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah. In fact, when I came back from Australia, he invited me to dinner. I was at Continental, and it was apparent that he was fishing around for somebody to front a new startup airline for him. And I was not interested.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Gordon Bethune was a fascinating guy to work for. He had a very colorful and has a very colorful vocabulary.
Yes.
You know, what you see is what you get. He was once asked in my presence, you know, Gordon, what do you like best? Sex, steak, or scotch? He said, it depends on what I had last. and that was typical of Bethune. When I went to Continental, I'll tell you the story about how that came about. I was in Australia. We had gotten the airline up and running, having a good time. We were operating MD-80s up and down the East Coast, all the way from Cairns to Adelaide. And it turned out that the gentleman that had hired me embezzled $12 million of our working capital. Ooh. And in Australia, they did not have a Chapter 11. If you traded at a time that you could not meet your debts as and when they became due and payable, the board became personally liable. Hmm. So one day I'm running a fun little airline. The next day I'm in court in Queensland asking for a receiver. And that was the protection that the board had to have. I was trying to play the string out. I wanted to sell it to Air New Zealand. And I thought the CEO of Air New Zealand later told me he would have jumped at the opportunity, but the receiver wouldn't let me fly over to Auckland to do that. And one day I had finished jogging, still trying to play the string out. I came in the house in Brisbane. The phone was ringing, and I picked it up, still sweating, and a voice said, I read what happened. It sounded like you were running a good operation, but you sure picked a bad week to stop sniffing glue. And it was Bob Ferguson, who at that time was the CEO at Continental,
uh-huh.
and with whom I had worked at Braniff. And he said, if you're ready to come home, I may have another challenge for you. Hmm. And I said, well, I want to come home, but I don't have a way. I'm broke. And Continental brought us home about 3 weeks later, and 2 weeks after that, I was a senior vice president at Continental Airlines, and I will be forever grateful to Bob Ferguson for that. I thought I was going to get the top job. I headed up the Cal Light project, which didn't turn out very well, and met one morning with David Bonderman, who is the chairman of our board and whom I had known at Braniff. And he was very direct. He said, Sam, you may be the perfect guy, but I want somebody from a big company. And you've been running a little podunk airline in Australia, so you're not going to get the top job. And Gordon came in, and I ended up running in-flight customer relations and reservations at Continental for several years. When I took over in-flight, my oldest daughter, who's a career flight attendant, international flight attendant at American, started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? And she said, Dad, you're a suit. You don't have a clue. And I said, what do you mean? She said, you'll be in that corporate headquarters with all the other suits, and you don't know what we do. And I thought about it, And I said, you know, she has a point. So I moved my office from the American General Building in Houston out to Bush Intercontinental, went through flight attendant training, had the office right above the flight attendant base, was the oldest and ugliest flight attendant that Continental had, and had, you know, 10, 15, 20 of them in my office every day about one issue or another. But it did make a difference, and it made me appreciate being where the action is. So I've always appreciated the fact that she told me I was a suit.
That's tremendous. It's a great way to deal with it. And boy, if more people should.
That's one of the things Herb taught, you know, that you better care about your people. And I took that on to Slotsky's and every other organization that I've had the good fortune to be involved with.
So you were vice chair of the board of DFW Airport for 2 years and then chair for 2 years.
Yeah, and secretary 2 years before that.
Okay.
Served an extra year at the request of Mayor Rollins, mayor of Dallas at the time.
So tell us about the airport business. How different is it from the airline business?
It was the best unpaid job I have ever had. DFW, of course, until recently was the number two airport in the world in terms of passengers. It has been overtaken by Dubai. Atlanta's number one, Dubai's number two, and DFW's number three. We're fortunate to have a 17,000 acre piece of land that they built the airport on. And we've been going through a lot of add-ons, redoing terminals. The airport opened in 1974, so that's a long time. They've got a new Terminal F underway right now. And it was fascinating, being an airline guy, to watch how DFW partnered with its airline customers. And that's really important to do that. And they've built a great relationship. We're fortunate to have American Airlines is our lead tenant. They're over 80% of the traffic at DFW. And from my perspective, they asked me to attend international conferences because of my airline background. And during the 7 years I was on the board, through the efforts of our staff, and I was just a stand-in, we increased our international traffic over 34% at DFW and are now the leading international airport in the U.S. We have more international nonstop destinations than any other airport. It is a capital intensive, but at the same time, like airlines, it should be customer focused. And by customer, I mean both your employees and the people who come to the airport every day. And to their credit, DFW has done a great job of automating, of doing the best it can to make the process as smooth as possible. It's hard to do that when you have 80 or so million people coming through every year. And a lot of people are off base. I used to tell my flight attendants at Continental, not everybody comes to the airport every day. It's easy to embarrass someone because they're not in familiar territory. And please keep that, be sensitive to that. And it's important for our airport employees to recognize that same thing. And at DFW, we did our best to be customer focused. And Sean Donahue and his team have just done a fabulous job in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also got to serve on the Harlingen Airport Board for 6 years.
Which
was fun.
Yeah.
It was a give back to my hometown.
So are you, there's some rumblings around about, you know, consolidation in the industry, about fortress hubs, about even some people saying, oh, we need to re-regulate again or cap the market share of airlines at fortress hubs. So that there's more competition. Any of that make any sense to you?
Not really. I think that cat is out of the bag, or horse is out of the barn, however you want to describe it. Deregulation, for all its foibles, has allowed about 80 to 90% of the American public to fly. When I got in the industry, it was a wonderful thing to be a non-rev, because average load factors under the regulation that we had kept load factors around 53%. And so I could always get on a flight with my family first class and take them places. Today, good luck if you're a non-rev. Yeah. It is tough to get on an airplane because load factors, are above 80%.
So you mentioned Schlotzky's, and for those who are not familiar, Schlotzky's is a chain of restaurants that makes darn good sandwiches. I'm curious, did you bring anything from the airline business to the sandwich business?
Oh, you bet. I haven't had an original thought in my life. I've copied everything from everyone I can. At Continental, Gordon, when he took over as CEO and Bob Ferguson left, he said, we're going to have a go-forward plan, and we're going to fly to win. We're going to fund our future. We're going to make reliability a reality, because Continental was a pretty sorry airline, and we're going to enjoy working together. And years later, when I went to Schlotzky's, I copied that very go-forward plan. Uh-huh. Schlotzky's had over 500 restaurants throughout the U.S. Great product, but it had mucked up its menus. It had gotten very complicated. So we put together a go-forward plan there. We were going to work to win, start doing those things that made money, and quit doing those that didn't. Sounds basic, but it wasn't. We're going to have fun working together. We were going to fund our future by eliminating all necessary expenses and restructure our balance sheet and obtain the resources to permit us to grow. We're going to do best what we did best. About 60 or 70% of the sales at Schlotzky's were the original Schlotzky sandwich, which is a wonderful muffaletta. Yeah. But they had gotten 20-some types of sauce and 20-some types of lettuce and all these different sandwiches. And, that's not what people came to Schlotzky's for.
Yeah.
And then finally, we're going to quit fighting with our franchisees. They were going to be customer number one. And it worked out. And what I have found, and it applies to me as much as anybody else, is that the management team that gets a company in trouble is very seldom the team that can get it out. And it's not that they're bad people. And I had to let go over half of the management at Schlotzky's. It's that they're intellectually and emotionally committed to those decisions that got the thing in the ditch to begin with.
Yeah.
When I walked into Schlotzky's, I didn't know anything about quick service restaurants. And I said, I'd like everybody to give me no more than 2 pages on what you would do if you were in my position. And about half the people spent the whole 2 pages justifying what had gotten the company in trouble. And the other half gave me the tools that we use to get it out of the ditch. Mm-hmm. So we eliminated that first half, and we worked with the second half and were able to save the company. And today it's a very strong company. It's owned by Focus Brands out of Atlanta.
That's terrific advice for any business. So as you look at airlines today, what do you think they do well, and what do they need to do better?
Well, going back to your fortress hubs, you can get most anywhere you want to go from Atlanta, from Chicago, even from Houston, and not to mention DFW. And I think that's an advantage to the traveling public. I see customer service especially in flight, tending to suffer in some regards. And you know, I don't want to be too critical because it's a tough job, and it was made even tougher during COVID when you're dealing with people who are on edge and who come to the airport carrying all kinds of emotional baggage. But you look at airlines like Emirates and Qatar, Etihad, Singapore, Cathay Pacific, and the customer service that they issue or offer. And the more you can emulate that type of friendliness, the better off the industry will be.
Interesting.
Southwest still does a good job in that regard. I you know, they keep it simple. They don't try to make you think you're going to have a love affair flying from Dallas to El Paso, but they do a good job. They're generally on time, and it's generally good value.
Yeah, yeah. And employees still seem, some of them, still seem to have fun with it.
I think that's right. You know, I tell people the dumbest thing I ever did career-wise was to leave Southwest Airlines. You know, but this was 1984, and I knew Herb wasn't going anywhere, and my ego got the best of my good sense. And when Muse Air offered me the presidency, and subsequently Braniff Mark II offered me the presidency, I couldn't resist, and I went to Muse, and a year later, Southwest bought us. And Herb said, "I love you, but you can't come home." And I understood that. And so I got out of the industry for a while and ran a holding company here in Dallas until I got recruited to go to Australia.
Interesting. So looking back on your career, any favorite stories, crazy stories, or just plain fun episodes?
Well, you know, working for Herb was always fun. Howard Putnam was a fun guy to work for. You know, I went to Braniff when it was brain dead. It had gone from being one of the leading carriers at the beginning of deregulation to being seriously upside down when I got there in 1981. In 78, when Carter signed the Deregulation Act, interest rates were about 8%, which we look at now as high, but at the time it didn't seem that way.
Yeah.
Fuel prices were around 30 cents a gallon, and the economy was strong. When I walked in the door with under Howard Putnam in 1981, interest rates had spiked at 21%. Fuel prices were $1.30 a gallon, and the economy was in the tank. And we had a $700 million, that was our revenue base, and we had almost that much in debt. And we had 39 senior lenders and no lead bank. If you think about that, had we had a lead bank, it might have turned out differently, but I felt like we were a wounded deer at the side of the trail, and the wolves were fighting over who got the first bite, because the old bank lenders didn't like the new bank lenders, and the old insurance lenders didn't like the new insurance lenders. And then you had Boeing and you had Pratt & Whitney, and it was just an untenable situation to deal with. And sure enough, after 2 years, we had to put it in Chapter 11. But during that time, two things that I really appreciated about Putnam, he was colorblind. And his choice of ties and shirts and sport coats, they were not the best. And he walked into a staff meeting one morning, and I couldn't resist. I said, "Howard, it looks like you went hunting and shot a couch." And, you know, if a guy hadn't had a sense of humor, and especially under the stress we were under, he would run me off immediately. And again, during one of our serious staff meetings, you know, where we were talking about this and that and having to ground this and give up that. I said, just remember, guys, we sure picked a bad week to stop sniffing glue. It was the same line that Bob Ferguson used on me later on in life.
Yeah.
To his credit, Putnam had a great sense of humor and put up with my irreverence and inability to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
Herb was good at that, too. His view was two things. One, you hire for attitude, you train for skill. You don't let somebody in the door if they're sour on life, because they'll ruin, it's like that bad apple. They'll ruin the whole barrel. And he also said, you take yourself not too seriously, but take your job very seriously. And I always appreciated that. You know, he wasn't afraid to laugh at himself. And he wasn't afraid to have us laugh along with him.
Yeah. No, that's very true. So if you were young Sam coming off that Rio Grande Valley farm, what advice would you give to yourself about the airline business and the career that might be ahead?
It's the same advice I gave to somebody a few years ago when he was considering going to Southwest Airlines, and he was in the media business at the time. And I said, if you have a chance, take it. But learn the business. Don't just be a media guy. You know, learn what ASMs are, what RPMs are, you know, how to calculate a load factor. Learn the economics of the business. I was late in doing that at Texas International, and that was one of my weaknesses. And so I would encourage people who want to go into aviation. It's a fascinating industry. It's, you know, the only industry I know of where you take your principal asset, your aircraft, and subject it to every conceivable ecological, weather, political environment that you could have. It is labor intensive. It is people intensive. Because it's labor intensive, it's fuel intensive, and it's capital intensive. And it makes no sense economically that it would operate.
Yeah, but it does,
and it's every day it's a different world. So it's fascinating. It's been awfully good to me, and I'm very grateful that that I've had the supporting roles that I've had over the years.
Well, Sam, this conversation has been fascinating, and I'm very grateful we could do it. Thank you so much for being with us on Airlines Confidential.
It's been my pleasure.
All right, we'll be right back with more on Airlines Confidential.
Promotional consideration provided by thearchive.net, celebrating 20 years with a fresh new look and over 60,000 items of AvGeek goodness. It's the hub of air transport history, and you're welcome aboard thearchive.net.
Thanks again to Sam and to you, Scott. I'm sorry I had to miss that interview. It was a fun conversation. I want to remind listeners that Airlines Confidential will be on stage for a keynote podcast at Aviation Festival Americas on May 15th in Miami Beach. This is the 16th year for Aviation Festival Americas, and it brings together more than 250 influential leaders from the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. If you'd like to attend, listeners can get a 50% discount by going to airlinesconfidential.com, clicking on the Aviation Festival banner ad, and using the promo code AC50. It's going to be a great event, and we are looking forward to being part of it.
Ben, the mailbag is empty this week. Come on, listeners, send those questions in. But lacking listener questions, I wanted to pose a question. What do you think was the best airline marketing campaign? Thought it might be a good time to ask the question since Southwest is launching a new branding campaign. I have my favorites. What about you? Let me start with something special in the air. In the golden era when American was showcasing gray-haired captains and gorgeous beach sunsets, that was what airline travel was all about. It was a memorable slogan and a motivating slogan. And I suppose it lost its punch when American was no longer something special in the air, but I've always thought that was one of the best.
Scott, call me a curmudgeon, but there is no ongoing airline campaign that I've liked. So I'll tell you one that I really hated. This one is also from American, from when they used "We know why you fly." I thought that was incredibly obnoxious and somewhat condescending. They know I bought a ticket, but they really have no idea why I am taking the trip. Why do they try to tell me that they do? Stick to what you know and don't presume things about your customers.
So one I thought was good was "Fly the Friendly Skies" with the Gershwin music. I thought United used that very well. And another United favorite was in 1990 when the CEO or team leader or whoever he was talked about the customers that they weren't going to see. They were doing business by phone and fax. And so they were getting fired and he was handing out tickets. And then they said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "I'm going to go visit that old friend who fired us this morning." I thought that was an effective ad. Any you liked?
The National Airlines "Fly Me" ad is memorable, but kind of sexist, so wouldn't fly today.
Yeah, no, that one's quite controversial, isn't it? One of the ones that more recent times that I really liked was "Want to Get Away" with Southwest. All those awkward moments, that we could all relate to and "Want to Get Away." I thought that one worked pretty well. One of my all-time favorites was British Airways "To Fly to Serve." One time "To Fly to Serve" was slogan. It was part of their logo. And they used to have these great ads with wonderful images from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And then in the years when BA was really opening up the world, right? And then later years with Concorde and 747, I thought that just warmed your heart and made you feel good about BA and worked as a branding campaign. Well, that's it for another edition of Airlines Confidential.
We'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.
Have a good week, everyone.
This podcast is produced by Mass Media. Info at massmedia.net.